Welcome to Tech Load. Sandra Spencer here, lined up for you for the next hour. Tech headlines, news, info, music, and insights into the world of technology disruption to power communities. For more than 140 years, humankind have been able to light the world up with electricity. What would it take for every human on Earth to have access to electricity? What would it take for the cheapest, easiest, fastest technology and logistics to power every home in the remotest regions? To discuss emerging disruptive technology to power communities is a tech disruptor with a track record. In the studio is Mark Tipping, an accomplished disruptor passionate about providing energy anywhere to everyone, from safe, simple, plug-and-play technology that can be installed by virtually anyone to large energy storage solutions, delivered complete and ready for connection. So that's quite a big call there. A technology strategist who successfully led complex and challenging transformations, how so, and complicated and at times politically hostile environments for more than 25 years. A warm welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Sandra.
And what do you love about technology?
I like the potential of technology. We can do many, many, many things with it. And its ability to dramatically improve our existence, our lives.
And how's technology improved your life?
In many, many ways. I don't walk to work anymore, let's just say that. I have the pleasure of driving a wonderful car, which is a full technology on wheels, Tesla. And it helps simplify everything that we're doing.
What do you think the biggest tech challenges are ahead for us?
Well, I think energy itself is the interesting challenge now, and the transformation into from our traditional coal and diesel-powered energy sources through to sustainable energy. And that's the big challenge for us at the moment. How do we move through from where we are today to where we need to be as a planet?
That's right. And tech disruption, how would you define that?
Tech disruption is the ability to turn something on its head and use technology to improve the outcome for people.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think have been some of the biggest tech disruptions we've seen?
Well, we can go back 20 years to .com. There's a big disruption there, the way we communicate, and fundamentally changed throughout the planet at that point in time. And then we can look to what we're doing right now with the new energy revolution, which will fundamentally change how humans consume or generate electricity and energy.
Yeah, and you see yourself as a tech disruptor, and what sort of disruption are you involved in, and how disruptive is it?
So with what we do is we can actually electrify villages, and that's our focus at the moment, is going into remote communities and being able to electrify them, and we can electrify a dwelling in 90 minutes.
And 90 minutes?
90 minutes. We can go in there and provide that house with communications.
That sounds like quite a good quick plug and play.
Oh, it's a very quick plug and play. Deliver three or four.
I spent a lot more time plugging and trying to play a lot of things.
If you think about it, it's a lot faster than programming old VCR, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. And the printer that I have yet to work out at home.
yeah, no, a lot faster than that. Basically, we can drop some boxes outside a dwelling, and with a little bit of guidance, the villagers themselves can actually roll out the solar tarp and tie it to their roof, plug it into one of our energy cubes, and we have communications built in there, so satellite broadband connectivity and lighting, and suddenly you've moved that village, you'll take the whole village from living hundreds of years in the past to today, where they can be educated and safety improvements from lighting and things like that.
Yeah, and so if we look at, 140 years we've had electricity, and so why is it, do you think, that a lot of homes and villages and communities and countries all over the world don't have access to electricity? Why do you think this is?
Money. Money is a simple reason than complexity. So if you're looking at using a traditional grid, as we all know, we all drive down the highway and look at these high power lines all down the road, they're pretty bloody expensive. And so to roll those out to a remote community isn't the solution. So currently you might roll out diesel generation and create a smaller grid around that area. That's still very expensive to do as well. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the ongoing cost of the diesel fuel itself. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you look at a country like Timor-Leste spends $180 million US every year just on diesel fuel to power Dili and some of their main cities So that ongoing cost is a big prohibitor.
So Edison Projects, the technology you're working with, how green is that? Well, how sustainable or renewable? There's still an energy component that is going to be not sustainable. Is that correct?
So everything we manufacture is designed to be cradle-to-cradle recycled. Okay. I think that's You have to do that these days. You can't be burying things in landfill. So we work with our suppliers and our partners to ensure that that's the case. And we can recycle 94% of the lithium iron from the back, from the cells themselves.
And will you be able to do that in the remote villages and communities and countries?
We need to take them back and...
Yeah, that's right.
We are custodians of those batteries and therefore responsible for their end of life. Mm-hmm. And so we need to take them back and then take them through our recycling partners.
Mm-hmm. So if we just have a look at your backstory, how did you get into tech?
Well, if I actually point it down, many years ago, as a young lad, I used to race motorcycles, and I was very privileged to be a part of the development team for a carbon fibre Kevlar 500cc Grand Prix.
Could you say that a bit slower?
Sorry. I get excited. So I was very privileged to be part of a development team on a Grand Prix motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
It was carbon fibre Kevlar. It was the first... Well, one of the first carbon fibre Kevlar motorcycles to be made, and that actually just fueled my passion.
Mm-hmm.
We went from traditional aluminium chassis to this carbon fibre chassis.
So you fell in love with technology because you had this initial passion and love for motorbike racing.
Yes. And it was the advantages that you could get through advancing technology to beat your competitors that fueled the passion.
Yeah.
And then from there, I just looked for opportunities. You know, what can technology do? And back in the start of the dot-com days, I actually developed a software as a service company. Back in the days when, if you remember, you'd install all your software on your computer, whereas we actually, in the very early days, and the biggest challenge was most people on dial-up modems, if you remember those. But you would actually...
No one wants to remember that.
Yeah, good point. Sitting there, tick, tick. Anyway, but we... developed some software as a service, so you'd actually dial into our servers and use the software there and not download it. You'd use a web browser, which was quite 25 years ago, it was quite advanced.
Quite revolutionary.
Yeah.
Just have a look at your passion for motorbike racing. What sort of characteristics or attributes do you need to be a great motorbike racer, and how might that apply to some of the skills you've transferred into business?
Well, there's an old saying is to finish first you must finish. So get the job done. And the other thing is when you're racing, you tend to be very pragmatic. The result is you need to be on the track to race and you need to finish that race. So, and everything else is secondary. So
you have really good focus.
So the focus is to achieve the goal.
What about risk? Because, like, if we compare it with car racing, that's... dangerous enough, but if we look at like motorbike racing, I mean, you really are exposed. So does that mean that the motorbike racers are more inclined to take more risks, and how would that apply to you and your business?
Well it's all calculated, of course. And I think when it comes to taking risks, if we talk about motorcycle racing for a moment, falling off doesn't hurt. It's a sudden stop at the end that does. So you're just mitigating those risks of making sure that there aren't walls in the way. And in the same way in business, you're making sure that you're planning that you're not going to come to a wall and how you're going to mitigate that.
Mm-hmm. So what projects are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, where our main focus is on the lighting and communications rollout into villages in initially Papua New Guinea and in a small country called Lesotho.
Mm-hmm. Which is landlocked.
Landlocked and mountainous. Mm-hmm. And we've actually been challenged to electrify that village because the only way there is by horseback or helicopter. So they've got no future. There's the cost of running infrastructure into that village is horrific.
Yeah.
And just can't be justified. And the cost of getting diesel delivered to run generators is...
It's not going to happen. No.
So the challenge was put to us is, can you electrify that village? And we've said we've risen to that one. And we're going through the planning stages at the moment, so hopefully...
Yeah, exciting. And I think when we were speaking earlier, I said, oh, will you use drones? Are there any plans for that? And so that is possible.
It is possible to deliver. We're talking with an Australian company at the moment that's designed some heavy lift drones. And if it all comes together, yes, we'll be flying them up via drone and also some leaders by helicopter as well.
I was surprised when I was reading, I picked up on 11%, and then I think you've since sort of corrected me and said the latest is 13.5% of Papua New Guinea have access to electricity.
Yeah.
That is frightening.
It's mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. They've got access to it's stable electricity, that is, so being able to plug something in and knowing that it's going to work. But at the moment, there's a large fund that's been put up by the Australian-US Japanese and New Zealand governments to actually move that from the 13-odd% up to 70% of the population over the coming 10 years. That's using traditional methods, so they're going to burn that money pretty quickly. The issue that we always had when we looked at it said, oh, that's great, bring it up to 70%, but that's 30% of people in the country are outside of scope.
Yeah.
And won't have electricity in 10 years' time.
So the haves and the have-nots.
The haves and the have-nots, and the only way you can move people, progress them, is they need energy.
Yeah, and what difference do you think it'll make? Like some people who are like, you know, people taking care of themselves, communities taking care of themselves, societies, countries. But is there an advantage in having the world powered?
Health is the biggest one, straight through. But then there's also the ability to educate. When you're providing communication channels, people can be educated. And when you educate people, they're less inclined to be led down the wrong path.
That's true. So you're saying that there could be more harmony potentially in geographical regions,
yes.
Less disruption, and that in fact there could be a greater evolution of humankind in general.
Being kind. You know, when we provide these communities with lighting, the safety for women and children increases massively. And when you then provide them with communication so that then they can educate themselves, they can look up and, you know, Dr. Google sort of thing. They can look at health problems and they can do all these things themselves.
And it's a mark of civilization, isn't it, to care about others.
Yes.
Whether or not they're in your local vicinity or not.
Or elsewhere.
They're in your community or other communities or other countries. That is civilization.
Exactly. And once you've given them the communications and the energy, you've then given the opportunity for the small business and micro businesses and so they can prosper and grow. Mm-hmm. And because until you do that, let's be honest, there's not many tourist areas that don't have any electricity, are there?
Good point.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, good point. Now, Mark, can you give us a clue or some idea about the type of milestones Edison Projects has had to date?
From the original concept of where we are and our journey to get to delivering things. So it was the original concept, the actual proof of concept model that we've built. We actually sat on the side of the road and charged two Teslas in the middle of the country, New South Wales, using one of our boxes.
How long did that take?
We didn't fully charge them.
It was just a test.
It was just a testing. It was just for a little bit of a laugh to say, right, we've got the two cars here, we've got the energy cube here, let's plug them in, and we did so. So getting the proof of concept right was really important, and then now we're working with CSIRO, of course, to build the final ready for production model.
Okay, and the CSIRO are putting some R&D money into this project, are they?
Yeah, we're between ourselves and CSIRO, yes.
Yeah.
So that they have a program, Kickstarter program, that we're involved in.
Mm-hmm. And so what are your thoughts and values on how we can work with technology to better lives, society and humanity? What are the values that Edison Projects
We are a values-driven organisation. It's not about making money. It's more about putting communities first. And our number one value is communities before self. And what that means, in layman's terms, it's we look after each other and we look after the villages and we look after the sphere of where we touch. And rather than trying to climb ourselves up, we just help everybody and that pushes everybody up.
Mm-hmm. And so is there a possibility that you'll also have a more commercial aspect to Edison Projects as well going forward, or will it just be purely sort of social enterprise focused?
Edison is a for-profit social enterprise, so it will make money,
mm-hmm.
and its forecasts are very healthy. But that's not the driver as such. What we'd rather do, and everybody involved in the business would rather say, we're okay, let's now help more people and let's give them more electricity, more energy, give them an opportunity.
So will you
be
creating a fund as part of the corporate structure as well so that you might be able to have some projects that would be really cheap?
So a foundation, we're establishing a foundation. The foundation will, we're actually going off the Bosch model, Bosch family's model as I understand it, which is they actually, when they created the company and they hit a level of success, they actually transferred part of the ownership of the company to their foundation. And so that means that the foundation will always have control and be able to do more work. And for us, we want to be able to do more R&D work and look at new other solutions and be able to fund that without shareholders saying, suddenly going, hang on, we need to do this. So if we make the foundation a shareholder...
Wow. So this will temper potential greed and agendas and lobbying amongst the shareholders.
Yes.
Perhaps too much of a commercial pursuit.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a commercial enterprise, but with a social foundation.
With a social bent, yes.
Okay. So if we have a look at your current technology, give us an overview and breakdown of that. And, is some of that technology patented or is it paintable?
We have two patents on some of our products. Basically, our technology, I'll describe it for you a little bit. So it's a number of things brought together. There's what we've developed is a solar tarp, what we call the energy tarp. And that's a very lightweight, flexible, basically solar tarpaulin.
Yeah.
So we've got the solar tarp that's lightweight, flexible, and can be thrown on the ground or thrown on a roof. That connects to what we call the energy cube, which is really the guts of what we do. And the energy cube is...
I love the name, energy cube.
Energy cube, yeah.
It reminds me of the dance floor.
Full of energy. And so that's actually the safest lithium-ion storage available. And it's very important for us that it was super safe, because we're actually putting these inside people's homes. If you've ever seen a lithium ion fire, a runaway, you can't put them out very simply, is the truth. So our cell design, which is patented cell design, manufactured by a partner of ours, you actually can't have a thermal runaway with these cells. So you could pierce them
You've tested that.
Yeah. It. New York Fire Brigade recently announced that it is the safest storage
so
in the world.
And so you've been able to achieve and deliver that level of safety.
Yeah, and which is critical because, these people, we don't want the houses burning down. Simple. And then connected to that, that also has all the management systems and the smarts that are required to control that, and the inverters and things to be able to output. We also have built into that a broadband router as well. Mm-hmm. So the energy cube becomes its own hotspot.
Does it heat up a lot or not?
No.
Not like my MacBook.
No. We're quite fortunate. The cells themselves are hot weather optimized as well, so they don't need as much cooling. So it was one of the things we had to work around was parasitic waste. And what that is the battery itself needing to use energy to keep itself cool.
Ah, and so does it eat up like a parasite?
Yeah, that's
surrounding it's material.
It just consumes the energy it's supposed to be storing to keep it cool. So we've optimized ours for hot weather so that it doesn't need that level of cooling. So more of the stored energy is actually able to be used. So we have that with the built-in Wi-Fi into it, and then it also comes with some flexible lighting as well. And the final piece of the kit.
Flexible lighting, what do you mean by this?
Basically an LED chain so that people can put it up on their walls or outside.
That's super modern.
Super simple.
I've got some of those at my place.
Yeah, I've got some
modern.
In the tree.
Yeah, exactly. Christmas. All year, every day.
And so they're lightweight and they'll be placed in the dwelling where somebody wants them. Yeah. And then the final piece of the kit is, and this is going to test some of your younger listeners at the moment, but is effectively what us older folk would call a dumb terminal. And inside our energy cube, we actually have a very small microcomputer that is basically a web browser, but outside of it is a keyboard and a screen. And there's no smarts in that keyboard or screen. It just plugs into our box.
Mm.
And the reason for that is theft is a problem. And if we put a little laptop there, they'd get stolen. But if we put a dumb terminal there, that can't work unless it's plugged into the box. There's no incentive to steal it.
No.
So that's the kit. So when we drop the kits off.
Yeah, smart.
You get your lighting, you get your communications, you've got a browser to be able to access the internet and the information. And if required, a refrigerator as well.
And did it take a long time to actually pull all that together?
Couple of years.
Oh, just a few sleepless nights.
Just a couple. Yeah, that's it. Just easy. No, it has been several years that we've been working through the designs and enhancing them and testing them and breaking them.
Yeah. And any tips that or advice you can give on that journey and the type of team and the people that were involved along the way?
You can't do it on your own.
Yeah.
Is really simple. You can do X amount on your own, but you need support. I've got a very supportive co-founder. That's fantastic. I can bounce ideas off him all the time.
And what's his background or her background?
He's actually an anaesthetist, but he's very passionate.
He's putting you to sleep because you stay awake too much.
That has been suggested, I think. He's passionate about providing power to communities as well, and we got together because that was what we were both passionate about.
Uh-huh. And so how did the two of you collide, were you?
we collided through Teslas. We both own Teslas. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the Tesla community is a community where people are quite conscious about sustainability, of course, mm-hmm. And they're quite conscious about equity and fairness.
Mm-hmm. And so in terms of your solution is completely self-sufficient. So it's got the lithium battery, which, as you said, it's 94-96% recyclable.
Yeah.
With a pickup that you'll work out with logistics.
Yeah.
So what other competitive companies are offering similar solutions, or are there any?
Most competitive solutions are actually looking at microgrids and grids.
Okay. Simple as that.
Yeah.
And that's a completely different way of
it's
of
far more expensive
working.
Way of doing things. Ours is fully distributed. So on each house is a tarp to generate solar electricity. Inside each house is a storage solution, the energy cube. Inside each house is the appliances themselves. If that house, if they're, blow waving their hair and things like that and using up too much power, they can't draw on a grid. They'll learn not to use too much electricity. The only way to share electricity with your neighbour is to run an extension cord. And we've done that on purpose because the cost of connecting that grid is where the money really gets burnt up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
your technology is scalable, and mm-hmm. in time, people and villages will also be able to use the energy cubes to be able to set them up to be able to, say, power some manufacturing tools, factories, or
our cell design is scalable, and yes, we can do that. But our focus right now, though, is on the community themselves, and over time, as they grow and they prosper, there are opportunities to put in more solar and more storage and to run industries.
Mm-hmm. So along the way in your journey, did you go down some rabbit holes that were difficult to come back up out of? And like the wrong people in the team, or did you take a tact with technology that was in a direction that is not where you're at now? How did you mitigate that and how did you work through that?
You are
the leader of the company.
Yeah.
Not the rabbit in the hole.
We looked at a number of technologies, obviously, because there's things around the cost and the availability of storage solutions. We looked at super capacitors and ultra capacitors, and even as far as I went to San Diego to visit a company called Maxwell, and some of your listeners will know who Maxwell are, and the day before I got there, Elon Musk bought the company. So that was a rabbit hole. Back home I go now. But so we've done things like that, and as we've grown as a business, we've really tightened down on the value side of things, and we have actually parted from some of the people who are early in the team, which is hard.
They didn't die.
No. They've continued on, and we support them and the like. It was just
Will they retain shares, or how does that work?
No. It was early days when
early days.
We were all bootstrapping.
Yeah. And that's what happens. So how can you find the right people, or is that just the journey and it really depends on what's at hand?
Well, a lot of it goes around to the mission that we're on. And when we talk to people, say that we power communities and we want to provide these benefits to people, other people just get
excited
and they want to be part of it.
Mm, so you feel like this is a natural magnet.
It is a natural magnet. We've got some fantastic people on the team. There's about 10 of us working full time, and we also have a great board as well that we can tap on the shoulder any time mm-hmm. we want to say, hey, I need to know about this. And I think that's key.
Mm-hmm. So the communication lines are
open, transparent. One of our values is everybody has a voice. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't matter if it's We've got a junior intern working with us. She's brilliant. Her voice is equal to mine.
So that's easier, it has to be said, with a team of 10 or less. And how do you think you will keep that transparency going forward when your team grows?
Reinforcement, basically, and walking the talk. We do have our Executive Director of People Experience, Kate, who's charged with that mission.
And today with technology, I mean, we've been all reading, you know, articles where it says, you know, thousands of employees are now more on an equal playing field because they can actually all log in and be on that Zoom meeting,
yes,
which may have in the past been just physical with only a handful of people.
Yeah, we've been fortunate. We've basically run the company on Google Meet since day one. And because we're a distributed company anyway, there's myself in central Victoria and there's others in Melbourne, some in Canberra and Sydney as well. So we've always used that model and it's worked quite well for us.
Mm-hmm. So what do you need to be a tech disruptor that actually delivers and makes a difference? What characteristics do you need?
You need to be personable, to be able to bring people onto the team and keep them excited, and you need to empower them. So you can't do everything yourself, and I don't believe you can control everything yourself. There are some notable jobs and things like that. We're very good at leading in that style, whereas my style is very different. I much prefer to bring on people who are very knowledgeable and say, that's your area of expertise, tell me.
And so where does the ego begin and end? How much of an ego do you need to be a leader to make it today in disruption? Where does the ego begin and end?
That's a bit of a tough one.
It is, actually, and feel free not to answer it. I think a lot of us out there are working that out because you probably need to be fluid.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to get anything done, your ego needs to kick in at certain times, for sure.
There are times when you have to drive, but there are also times, you know, if you muck up, if you make a mistake, you've got to be of the character to be able to say, hey, guys, I got that wrong. And the moment you can say that to your team, they'll respect you even more and they'll work even harder.
Now, Mark, how important is it to learn how to fail as you're working through with disruption and moving a technology company?
I think we need to accept that failure is part of reality and be prepared to fail. And I think Edison, actually, of all people, summed it up when he was trying to invent the incandescent light globe, who said, I haven't failed 10,000 times. I've just found 10,000 ways it won't work. And I think if we look at our failures that way and say, okay, well, that was a lesson. What do I learn from it? And how do I try not to do it again? That's how we move forward. But if you find yourself making the same failure over and over again, I think you've got to do some reflection.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on how tech companies in Australia particularly can get off the ground, grow and realise their potential with best outcomes?
Well, there's a lot of incubators here in Australia now, and particularly if you're looking in the energy space as well, there's a lot going on. Align yourselves with the incubators, but think about carefully before you jump into bed with them. You need to make sure that they can give you what you need. The important thing, though, is don't wait. You know, people are saying, oh, I'm waiting on this grant, or I'm waiting on approval, or I'm waiting on... No, don't. And we took a very hard line when it came to grants and the like.
Because it can take a long time and people can be under the impression, oh, it's just going to come next week, next day, next month. And then they can lose a lot of momentum.
Well, you can lose your market advantage and then the whole business is over.
And morale.
So, yeah, and morale. But I learnt that lesson many years ago working with a university. And I was saying, I need this product finished so I can go to market and make some money to be able to pay my staff. And they weren't driven by the same commercial requirements as I was.
So have you always been working like with a minimal viable product type of thing in mind?
In mind, yes.
That you can start getting revenue?
So you can get the product out there, you can learn from that, you can add more features as you move forward. I mean, our solution started as simple storage and then we added more to it and added the Wi-Fi to
That's
it.
Right, and this was over an 8-year period?
For this one, it was for the Energy Cube, it was over a couple of years.
Okay.
But yeah, it's important that if you've got the concept, you start working it and you work it hard and you keep going and don't let people slow you down.
Mm-hmm. And so if you weren't disrupting in the energy market, what market would you be disrupting in?
water. probably.
Okay. And could that be the next thing that might lead from Edison Projects Australia?
So our big hairy plan is to look at the energy problem, find a solution for the energy problem. We'll look at the water problem, find a solution for that, and hopefully move on to food.
Okay, because there's a big thing about food scarcity.
Food scarcity, yeah. And we live in an amazing country that if you just pipe water to the middle of it.
That's right. And it's not just scarcity, it's also the food security.
Yeah.
But then if the security is at risk, then surely the food becomes even more scarce.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the first thing you need to secure is your energy.
Yeah.
Because if we lose the energy, so if, you know, someone parks some battleships off the coast of Australia and we can't get the oil through, we're going to run out of oil very, very quickly.
So how different, you've come from a corporate background, so how different is it from working in the corporate arena to, I suppose, the startup and growth company arena?
I've been involved in a number of startups. I've tended to work on startups and build the businesses and then go into consulting side of things and do
so
work.
You've already had a bit of a mix in those corporate days.
Yeah, I started my first business when I was 19 years old. So transportation.
What? Not just motorbikes?
A bit more than trucking, but basically running a service for trucking companies of running casuals to load and unload trucks first thing in the morning and last thing at night for them. And that was my first business venture. Going back many years ago.
And what have you
now
learned?
Now I'm feeling old.
What have you learned since then? from the successes that you had with the first company, what have you taken from that first company experience to what you now practice today and work with today?
Stick to scope. Scope creep is a killer. And keep to what you're saying you're going to do and do it, as opposed to just looking at the next shiny toy and moving on to that and not quite finishing. So that's to me is key, is deliver on what you're going to say.
Mm-hmm. And what other areas of technology do you think we're going to see big advancements in, like in terms of, say, just even the health sector?
Health testing. New methods for health testing and things like that will come to the fore. I think the big one that we all talk about is full self-driving of cars, mm-hmm. which will happen. There's no ifs, no buts about that one. And it's going to happen a lot sooner than most people realise.
No, and because they've been working on it for a long, long time.
They've been working on it for a long, long time. You've got cars today that are driving down the highway, making their own driving decisions today.
Today.
And
I did do a test drive with a Tesla recently, and it was observed that there were a few decisions that were being made that were beyond my control.
Yes.
Like the car refused to go any closer to a car that was in front.
Yes, that's correct. And it will also slow its acceleration if there's something right in front of it.
And could that be dangerous? Didn't seem to be. I mean, it was a great experience, but
statistically, when a Tesla's on autopilot, it's four times safer than a human being. So, and I am a big driver. I do a lot of miles every day, a couple hundred kilometres, and my car drives about 190 of those on its own with me watching.
Yeah.
So the car will actually drive down the highway, indicate, pass a truck, move back in, take the ring road turn off all by itself with me just watching it to make sure it doesn't make a mistake.
Yeah, so how can people stay relevant? How, like, we've got 140 years, as we said in the intro, of electricity, and yet so many people all over the world and homes and villages don't have access to electricity.
Mm-hmm.
We're moving into a world where there's huge amount of technology advancements, where, as you're just talking now, self-driving vehicles. How do people stay relevant, and how do they stay in a way that they can adapt with technology in a way that's healthy?
I think it's the ability to choose the technology, and we understand. So there are things we're quite happy to let go. I'm quite happy to not drive a car in peak hour traffic ever again, right? If I could let the car do that, very happy that I could read a book. Can't yet. But then there are times when you would take it over. If you like to drive, you go to a winding road and you drive the car at that point and enjoy it and let the car take you back home again. So I think it's a matter of picking and choosing technology and understanding it. I mean, there's some things in AI that I worry about. Mm-hmm. And
the bias.
There's, you know, at the end of the day, a program's only as good as the programmer and the requirements that are set for that. So if we don't set AI up correctly, it could suddenly start making decisions like Skynet. You know, results in a outcome that we're not happy with as human beings.
And is that that's also kind of inbuilt in the nature of some of the technology that we've actually set up for ourselves? That
yes.
The computers, like my MacBook, over the years, I've had lots of different MacBooks since the very first release of one. And, sometimes those programs just take over and make decisions for me.
Correct.
And I didn't agree. Well, I had no power.
It suddenly did that.
Suddenly did that, yeah. And so now they talk about in the future that, you know, AI and computers will be able to actually communicate in a new language that we may not understand. So we've got to make sure that we put things in the, you know, backup so that we'll have access to be able to work out what is that language that they've created that they're actually communicating about. And then, of course, you've got the idea that computers will be able to, or technology will be able to, like, write its own programs.
Which it's already doing. And this isn't my area of expertise at all, so...
Is that something you think we need to have some regulation on?
I think we definitely need to be on the front foot and not wait. But unfortunately, in most cases, regulations are always following. And it's the oops crash moment that says, oh, we better regulate that. And I think when it comes to AI, there's some very smart people working on it that probably are more aware and should be leading how we control it.
There should be more forums, or we need to have those people who are on the front line or in the engine rooms who are working on this technology to come out and to be able to communicate exactly what is happening, so we can have a better means of navigating
and understanding
regulations. Yeah, because it seems like everything's happening so fast, and it's an afterthought, or we're regulating, and these groups and bodies globally and nationally are just sort of lagging behind. What's the regulation like for self-driving cars? Is that something that you
regulation
know about in Australia? Or is that something that they're going to change, or people feed into that?
Well, what will actually most likely happen in Australia is there are cars with full self-driving capability now. They've got the technology, the software hasn't been switched on. There's cars in America at the moment that are driving around under a beta test of full self-driving. Because the technology is actually safer than a human, and it's legal today if there's a human sitting behind the wheel. So what will probably happen is that the insurance companies will sit there and go, that car's got full self-driving, it's not crashing, therefore... That car doesn't, I'm going to increase the policy.
Wow, so the market will
the
help
market will
determine
drive it. Yes.
The take-up of the self-driving vehicles.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but for the time being, the legislation will require a human being to sit beside it and, in theory, not use their phone or their computer.
That's right. Yeah. So one last comment on humanity and technology, and can they go together?
Absolutely. Technology is something that should be used to empower human beings.
And on that note, thank you so much, Mark, for being in the studio.
Thank you.
And thank you for your company here on TechLoad.